Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
I just want to thank everybody who is listening this Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. I just want to give a real quick special shout out to Sam Neill. RIP, we all loved, of course, Dr. Alan Grant in Jurassic Park. We were all terrified of Dr. William Weir in Event Horizon, at least for the first 80% of Event Horizon. He was one of the best to ever do it. And we are not going to discuss him on today's episode, but I will throw it open to folks in the subscriber-only chat to discuss what your favorite Sam Neill role was. I wrote a quick obit. I'll put that there as well. But if you have some Sam Neill thoughts, some Sam Neill memories, some your favorite Sam Neill movie. I didn't go for a lot of deep cuts in my obituary. It went for pretty much the standard fare. So if there's something a little bit off the beaten path you want to mention, throw it in there. And now on to controversies and non-troversies, where we find that Netflix seems to be losing audience after its first seasons of shows. As Lucas Shaw reported in Bloomberg, season one of One Piece was down about 30% compared to its first season. Season two was down about 30% compared to its first season. Beef dropped more than 70%. The Night Agent's audience dropped by half between season two and season three, and then another third, a little more than a third, between seasons two and season three. Avatar, The Last Airbender, is down 60% in its first weekend. First week, not weekend, sorry. Box office, different stats. All of this is to suggest that Netflix's woes are not over yet. Richard Rushfield suggested that Netflix's problem here is born of its identity as a tech company first and foremost. The tech world is built on novelty. Ooh, look at this shiny new doodad. Look at this fancy new chatbot. While TV is built on stability. You make 5 new shows a year, and every 3 years, one of those shows turns into a syndicatable hit that runs for 3 decades. As Richard puts it, a hit show with a devoted audience used to be the most valuable thing in Hollywood, if not the most valuable thing in all of business. Once you had millions of people committed to following a few characters, you could roll out series until the end of time with reliable, predictable results. Part of the problem is that Netflix doesn't spend any money on their marketing efforts, right? Outside of a few buzzy titles like Stranger Things or Bridgerton or Squid Games, they rely on their home screen, that dominating real estate space on your living room TV, to capture and then recapture the same audiences. But if you don't let people know about a show, it can't grow. That's why we need you to tell people about this show, folks. And if you don't let people know about a show, it is capped at whatever the original audience was. That is not a recipe for long-term success. I think we're nuts also if we don't acknowledge that at least part of the problem here is the binge release model. I would argue that there's a reason the second seasons of Landman and The Pit did such huge numbers. It's because audience had time to find and catch up with the shows. It's because you give people an option, right? They can watch it weekly, or they can let the shows build up and then binge them. But you're not just throwing it all out there at once. The binge model encourages all or nothing consumption from the get-go. It says, hey, we've got this whole thing here. You should watch the whole thing or not. We either way. And if you force people to make that choice, a not insignificant number of them are going to just choose nothing. But here's a trickier question. There is a tricky question here, and one that is almost impossible to answer. And that has to do with quality and taste, right? Netflix's biggest problem is that they simply do not have a Casey Bloys-like figure. He's the HBO head. They don't have a John Landgraf figure. He's the FX head. There's nobody at Netflix who has good enough taste and can ensure a level of quality control akin to that at HBO and FX. As a result, the buzzy shows on Netflix simply aren't as good. They are just not as good. And if they're not as good, you're not likely to retain those audiences. Peter, does any of this even really matter to Netflix? This is the thing I keep wondering about. Like, we're talking about these shows not doing well, and I'm sure that they are annoyed that the amount of money that they're spending is not paying off with, you know, extra eyeball hours or whatever. But you look at their overall numbers on the Nielsen gauge, they're not down that much. They fluctuate kind of within a 7 to 8 percentage point difference. Does the And then also they are shifting strategies here, right? Does the difficulty of maintaining these audiences explain why they've been shifting so hard to short form and live content in recent months and years?
So I think in some ways, people want to take down Netflix, and like it's the big boy on the block, and there's a little bit of Schadenfreude happening here, where people are looking at this and going, "Oh, your great business is maybe not as great as it looks." And then if you look at the actual numbers for today and for what we expect for this coming year, right? Like right now, Netflix's business is great in the moment, and I just don't think that they have a problem in July of 2026. And I don't think they're going to have a serious problem anytime in this calendar year. But when you think about what this says about their programming, people aren't coming back to it. And when you look at the Wall Street Journal report that followed up on this initial, I believe, Lucas Shaw report about declining season two numbers here, they're seeing a lack of engagement. They're not seeing cancellations. In fact, they have the lowest churn rate of any of the big streamers. Churn, for people who don't know, is the regular kind of the sort of monthly kind of cancellations that just happen in this business because it's subscription. And so nominally you sort of subscribe for a year, but like you can just pay for a month and watch Netflix for a month if you want. Netflix has the lowest rate, and that's very good for their numbers. That's good for them. So people aren't canceling yet. But what all of this says is that in the medium to long term, people don't care enough about their stuff to come back to it. And that's why they're shifting why there is discussion about having essentially kind of linear cable type channels that just sort of broadcast. That's why they are trying to beef up their efforts to produce YouTube-like short content to compete more directly with YouTube. And I think that's why we are seeing some shifting strategy here is they don't have, their strength is not producing things that people care enough about. And when you're spending a ton of money on a show like One Piece, which is a very expensive show to make, you need to have people come back. And the other streamers, Paramount has Taylor Sheridan. Apple TV has shows like Severance. HBO obviously just has a bunch of shows that even if you don't like House of the Dragon, and I did not love the start of season three is so bad that I quit the show. These are streamers, I should say, that have stuff that people talk about, care about, and are willing to wait for, and focus on when it comes out. Again, just look at Severance. I think it's really Severance is the answer to people who are like, look, we can just solve this by putting out a season a year. Severance is the first to second season is 3 years apart, and people went crazy for that show because that was a show with deep hooks. It like got people in their bones. And when was the last time that Netflix had a show like that? It's not just the binge model. It's not just the time between seasons. It is a quality problem. They do not have it. They just don't have a comparative advantage in producing stuff that people care deeply about. In fact, they have invested kind of specifically and intentionally in being the folding laundry network. And, I remember years ago, I can't remember what magazine, maybe it was Premiere, maybe it was Wired, did a feature piece on the making of Titanic. It came out kind of after the movie had been shot, but before it had come out, and kind of the frame for it was, is this another Waterworld, a famously expensive water-based movie? It was a huge flop, right? And there was a quote in it, I believe from James Cameron, that was like, this movie is either going to be all things to everyone or nothing to no one, right? Like it's a total binary here. And Netflix went real hard on we want to be all things to everyone. And it has actually worked pretty well for them. Like they've executed that strategy reasonably well. So like not just reasonably well, like let's be honest, let me be more clear here, very well so far. But by trying to just sort of check all the boxes, right? Whenever you hear about their content strategy, it's we want to make sure that there's something on our network that everyone likes. They don't say our content strategy is we're going to be excellent at reaching this audience. It's we're going to make sure that we have something for everyone. And because they're not striving for that kind of excellence for a particular audience, eventually they run the risk of losing maybe everyone.
See, I'm curious about this part, Alyssa, because I don't know that that's true, because I think it may be predicated on a misunderstanding that I personally have shared a little bit with what Netflix is, which is that Netflix is not an HBO, right? It's not a Peacock, it's not an Apple TV. It is a surrogate, a substitute for cable. It's what it is TBS that you pay $30 a month for at this point. You know, it has reruns of shows. It has some new stuff, but it's not that good. And it has movies that you're familiar with. And when you scroll by them on the tile, you click them and you go there. Peter said something to the effect of people don't care enough to come back for it. The it being the show, right? They don't, yeah. They watch a season of the show and they're like, yeah, that's fine. But they don't specifically come back for season number two. But the numbers show that they are still coming back to Netflix. Again, the numbers are pretty stable, you know, year over year. They're not vacillating wildly from, you know, some months it's 15%, some months it's 5%. It's like 7 to 8% pretty much every month, which suggests to me, Alyssa, that, you know, you and me and Peter and other people in our cohort are unusual TV watchers. We watch specific things because we have other things we need to do. Maybe we're watching them for work. Maybe we're watching them for fun or whatever. But it's like, okay, somebody I know is talking about this show. I'm going to watch it on this streamer. Somebody's talking about this movie that's on this streamer now. I'm going to go watch that. Most people just turn on the TV. Most people just turn on the TV and watch. And in that circumstance...
Wait, most people don't have to watch television for work?
Well, I know. It's weird. And if that's the case, Alyssa, I think Netflix may be fine, frankly. They may just end up saving money by not making these big, dumb shows.
Yeah, and I think this is sort of the question for Netflix, right? Is it fundamentally sort of was getting into the original content business a mistake for Netflix, I think is sort of the question. And obviously it wasn't a mistake in that it helped grow the company into what it is today. But, you know, there are a lot of costs involved in starting up a television show that often, you know, if you are working on the old sitcom model or even, you know, the HBO model, you amortize over time, right? Like you have sets, you have costumes, you have, you know, work that goes into sort of script and character development. You have relationships with the actors and everyone gets paid out by you making a certain amount of this stuff on a regular predictable cadence and making enough of it over time to sort of sell repeatedly in multiple formats. And Netflix, because it drove the sort of the vertical integration of all of this, like because it was not, you know, Netflix is not producing shows for someone else. It was not, you know, it was not like syndicating things to other people. It was not, you know, licensing, you know, the secondary rights to anything. It didn't have the opportunities to make all of those, you know, those sort of subsidiary kinds of revenue. And I think that was, you know, pushing the rest of the industry to adopt that model has been, I think, really terrible for the business in a lot of ways. Like it has just sort of narrowed the kinds of revenue that can exist. But then for Netflix, once you get to a certain point, if you're just like, if turning on Netflix, so like I'm going to watch a little TV in the evening is for a lot of people synonymous with like, I'm just going to turn on Netflix and just kind of pick something that's there at random.
Yeah. It's new channel surfing.
Right. But then to what extent does it even make sense for Netflix to be making a lot of original content? I mean, does Netflix end up sort of rebuilding the old model? Because, you know, they are putting a lot of money into this stuff. The production deals that they signed with people were enormous. They've sort of stopped doing those. They really reined those in. But, you know, the model never worked in a lot of ways for what they were trying to do, and not just in, you know, sort of building audiences from season to season, right? Like I did back when I was writing a culture column for the Washington Post, I looked at the spikes in sort of Google Trends for Netflix shows relative to like HBO shows. And the HBO spikes were lower, but they were much longer. They were plateaus. The Netflix shows were extremely brief spikes that fell much further and much more quickly than the HBO or the FX shows. Like the binge model meant that there was just no conversation at all. And that was sort of fatal to the cause of building interest and like getting people on board over time. And that was exacerbated by the times in between seasons. But, you know, what you want to do if you're Netflix ideally is produce the next Friends, right? You want to produce like something where there is a lot of it, people will just sort of return to it mindlessly. And so I think there's just sort of some tension between the need to fill a lot of hours with, you know, stuff where there was a bar for what the content, what the quality of the content was going to look like. But there's an inconsistency in the model. And I wonder if they end up backing away from producing some of the content and going back to licensing it. I don't know. I mean, there's just what they've wanted to do and what their core business model is at various points has just not quite synced up in a way that lends itself to being understood as a coherent business cycle.
I mean, on the other hand, they're making a ton of money, like just an absolute boatload of money. It has been successful enough that you, in some ways, we have all sorts of criticisms, sort of our artistic criticisms, but like it's just obviously a successful business model.
Right.
Up till now, it's going to continue to be successful for at least a couple of years, even if there's some declines here. But I think you're really onto something. If I want to combine what both of you said, it's useful to think about, okay, this is the new cable bundle. And also, why are they making, where are they not just making original shows? They're making a lot of them and spending a ton of money on some of those shows. It's not just really cheap stuff. And if you think about it that way, then you have to ask two questions, I think. Number one is, if they're cable, go back to the sort of peak cable era, 1998, 2002 even. Those cable shows, those cable networks, didn't actually make a lot of original content. That is a relatively new development, right? FX kind of tried to run their own version of the HBO strategy, and that kicked off a lot of stuff. You can come up with some examples of some scripted shows. I'm not saying that there were literally zero, but there weren't that many scripted shows on cable until the kind of dawn of the FX era, the Shield, the stuff that came after that. And so cable was in part during its peak, not a place for originals, but just a place for reruns, which is what Netflix might become. But then the other thing is, if we think of this as just the thing that you watch when you don't care that much about what's on, it's that, you know, I'm going to go watch Netflix while, again, the Folding Laundry Network, then their real competitor isn't HBO and isn't Paramount even, right? It isn't any of these other streamers. It's YouTube. And why are you going to pay? Like, that's a big problem for them, because why are you going to pay $30 a month for Netflix when YouTube is out there for free? And we can see this already. This is why they are adopting YouTube-like features, is because they know that they're not actually competing with Apple TV, which is great, actually, which is maybe my favorite streamer at the moment, but nobody watches. They're not competing with HBO. They're competing with YouTube, which is this behemoth, which makes the Netflix business, as good as it is, as strong as their numbers are, their financials are, that YouTube numbers are bigger, both in terms of total audience and in terms of total revenue. And YouTube never has to take a risk on building its own show. They just pay people for when it's already a hit. Oh, you built this thing and it's a success? Well, you get a share of the revenues. Oh, you built this thing and spent a ton of money on it and no one watched? Guess what? We're paying nothing for it. Costs us zero.
And yes, Netflix is making a lot of money now, but I do think that, look, the low interest rate financing that drove Netflix's ability to really push into the original content space is over. We have not had a 2008-style recession that is going to push a lot of people into looking at their discretionary spending again. But I think it will be very interesting to see what happens when those two circumstances finally overlap and what Netflix has to become under those circumstances. Because if people aren't that engaged, if people aren't coming back, then it will become one of the discretionary expenses that people look a lot more carefully at.
Yeah, and that wasn't true of cable in the 90s, but one thing cable didn't have to do in the 1990s was there was no way to basically buy HBO as an independent service back then. HBO was an add-on. You had to start with the basic cable package.
I mean, we keep saying Netflix has a lot of money, and I don't think that really sells just how much money Netflix is making.
It's a lot.
Netflix, the 2025 revenue for Netflix was $45 billion with a B, which is roughly five times the entire domestic box office.
It's government program money.
you know, they Netflix has enough money to shed subscribers for a bit and be fine. Now, whether or not that impacts the stock price, which is what everybody cares about, I mean, the market cap, blah, blah, blah. This is a problem with the industry more broadly, the obsession with stock prices. But the simple truth is, you know, Netflix could stop producing 100% of their new programs tomorrow and probably not lose a single subscriber for, I don't know, a few months. And then after that, not really miss any of the ones. They could do the AOL strategy of just existing and collecting money from people for years, and people would get fabulously wealthy, but the company would end up going away. Okay, I guess, I mean, look, I don't know. I don't know if it's controversy or a non-controversy that Netflix is having trouble maintaining second season audiences, but I do think it's worth thinking about. Alyssa, what is your recommendation? You're now a marketing exec at Netflix.
I'm Ted Sarandos.
You're Queen Netflix. What do you do to get people just to watch a show that they watched in season one and liked? How do you maintain that audience?
I release the episodes in tranches rather than in binges. And I release, like, the first episode of the next season airs like 9 months after the last episode of the first season. You know, you don't let people forget that it's there.
Peter.
My actual response is that I appoint Alyssa head of a queen of Netflix. Okay. That's what I do. I put Alyssa in charge of things. I put Alyssa in charge of things, and I'll sit around and have ideas. You know, I'll be a minister without portfolio consultant type.
You guys want my
sci-fi detective show? You should give me money to make that.
I'll think about it, but not until we've made every season of the Julia Quinn Bridgerton novels and possibly some spinoffs. Definitely a Lady Whistledown show. And as Queen of Netflix, you're required to review all of them on the podcast.
Absolutely.
I'm going to make you guys do a Bridgerton
season. Queen of Netflix is not Queen of ATMA. This is still an equal partnership.
Yeah. It's not a... Anyway, first of all, Bridgerton.
Do you want your sci-fi detective show made, Peter? Do you?
Okay, no, now we're talking. I get it.
This is how the
please approve my merger.
Folks. This is how critics decide what they're going to do. Is the Netflix head tells them they'll greenlight their dumb pilot.
I'm just really the queen of everything. I mean, come on.
Okay. All right. Make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com for a bonus episode on The Odyssey, the book version of The Odyssey, the epic poem, not the movie. Our book club is wrapping up just in time for everyone to go see Christopher Nolan's new movie. So we're going to do one last bonus episode on the epic poem. And then maybe we'll discuss what our next book club selection will be. I don't know. We got to figure that out. Like, there's people demand book club stuff, maybe. I don't know. Maybe we're like Netflix and we don't need to do a book club. And that's just extra work. Let us know. We'll figure it out. And now on to the main event. The invite. Seth Rogen, Edward Norton, Penelope Cruz, and Olivia Wilde, all of whom have character names, but who I'm just going to refer to as the actors in this. I apologize, but I'm not. There's no reason to make you think about anything other than Seth Rogen, Edward Norton, Penelope Cruz, and Olivia Wilde. Olivia Wilde also directed, of course. Star in The Invite, which is a film about an indecent proposal, though it takes nearly an hour to get, more than an hour actually, to get there. To this indecent proposal. There's a lot of unhappiness to set up in this four-hander before we get there. Rogen and Wilde are unhappily married in San Francisco. Rogen's a former pop musician who's stuck at a dead-end teaching job at a small college, while Wilde is, I think, a stay-at-home mom who spends most of her time renovating their a massive apartment and redecorating it with various rugs and furniture. Paint hues, this is her concern. Wilde has invited the neighbors over for a dinner party, catching Rogen unaware. She insists, she told him the day before, and she is mad he has not brought a bottle of wine home. He's insistent that if this party happens, he will bring up the other couple's penchant for loud sex. He's going to embarrassingly discuss their loud sex because he's tired of hearing them have loud sex. And then you see the couple again, which is Ed Norton and Penelope Cruz. And you actually are like, oh, I actually hope they talk about sex. I hope they talk about Ed Norton and Penelope Cruz's loud sex. Could you bring it up sooner, please? That would be great. That's an attractive couple, folks. I'm sorry. I gotta say it. What follows is a little tete-a-tete, right? With Norton engaging in some radical honesty that leaves their host discombobulated. While Cruz, there's no word to describe this other than she just like straight up eye fucks them the whole time. It turns out that Cruz and Norton are A, swingers, and B, interested in inviting their neighbors over for one of their sex parties. Sex parties. That's where all the loud sex is coming from. Anyway, that is the titular invite. And also, the answer to Rogan's question. It takes us actually almost exactly 69 minutes to get to this point. I didn't have a stopwatch going, but I was just like, nice. This has to be a screenwriter joke, right? Like this is like, I looked at my watch. I was like, wait, this is the actual invite. This is the invite. We're about 70 minutes into this thing. So I'm just going to go with 69 minutes for the joke. And I guess that makes this nominally a spoiler, but you can't spoil the premise of a film. Like the whole premise, it's not my fault. It takes 69 minutes to get to the premise, which is the sex party invite. The broader point, though, is that the invite for the group sex isn't really the point of any of this. It's the end point. It's the real point of this film is to see the ways in which the ways in which Rogan and Wilde's relationship has evaporated. There's
not
any
love there.
Are you
saying that's the climax of the movie, Sonny?
Stop. Stop. You'll get your turn for your sex puns. You just wait. You wait your turn. Just like
I know it's
the
hard.
Sex party. Anyway, things are off the rails here. It is honest. Look, this. I'm going to be honest. This is kind of a tough watch, this movie. It's very personal. It's like so private. You can't. I'm watching this movie and I'm like, the writers who include Rashida Jones and I forget the name of the other guy. But Rashida Jones was one of the writers.
It's Will McCormick.
Eric McCormick. Thank you. Olivia Wilde is directing this. It's just, it feels like it's coming from a very personal place. I don't know. And it's funny, at least in part, because of the awkward truths that it's probing, right? It's funny because it's true. There's a lot of truth here. This is by far Wilde's best film. It's way funnier than Booksmart. I remember watching, I saw Booksmart with a paying audience on, you know, a Friday night or something with my wife, and we went to go see it. And we, everybody was there. They were primed to laugh. There were some, you know, some chuckles in the early going, and then it was silence for, like, the last 90 minutes of that movie. It was died in the theater in a way that I have rarely experienced with an acclaimed comedy. This movie did not. This movie, good laughs throughout. And it's way better than Don't Worry, Darling, which I thought was a conceptual mess. Edward Norton is kind of perfectly cast as the smarmy truth-teller. Who refuses to honor social boundaries, pushes everybody's buttons, which, you know, it's a little nice little synecdoche for this film. Cruz is very attractive. I can't say it enough. Who knew? Who knew she was so pretty? Alyssa, what did you make of the invite?
I feel like the only acceptable way to review this movie is by playing Fuck, Marry, Kill with the characters.
What?
Right.
I don't think that is appropriate. I think that's a good way to get us all canceled.
Really? I mean, I feel like because I all right.
Cancels on my wife.
There's four of them.
Right.
You can't.
Well, but what if you can do like you can either fuck two of them, marry two of them, or kill two of them? So you like you
Look,
have some choices.
We should not play this game. But if we're gonna play this game, we got to do it where it's fuck, marry, kill. But then one of them just gets left out because. That part of it is part of what's funny about this is Seth Rogen's constant fear of being left out of the sex party. Even before the sex party, part of it is, you know, announced and made explicit, like this sort of terror of being left out of this trio that clearly have some connection runs through the film.
No, I think this I liked this movie a lot more than I expected. The first 10 minutes of the movie, I will periodically, when I'm being a poorly behaved moviegoer, will text Peter and Sonny from within a movie just being like, I'm going to die. I hate this so much. And it came very close to texting you guys that like the movie just made me want to jump off a bridge because I found the first 10 minutes or so of it so tense and unpleasant. I think that it's very well done, right? It's like, it is very well calibrated to a certain kind of elder millennial malaise. The Brompton folding bike that Seth Rogen's character is sort of struggling to pedal up San Francisco hills and get out the door of his classroom is sort of exactly the sort of affectation that, you know, used to see a lot around neighborhoods occupied by people of a certain educational and socioeconomic status. The fussing over the decor, the obsession with like the perfect tablescape, you know, it's not quite like a, you know, butter plate or whatever. But the sort of, who didn't get a text and the evening is ruined as a result. Like it is very finely observed in both sort of the set decoration and the script. And the irritation is so perfectly, unpleasantly calibrated. And of course, I mean, the movie, as in sort of the evening within the movie itself, gets a lot more fun when Norton and Cruz show up because they have such kind of wonderful loopy energy. You know, Sunny, you mentioned Norton being perfectly cast here. And I was thinking about his performance in this relative to his performance in Glass Onion, the second Knives Out movie, which didn't quite work to me, in part because I thought the script was trying so hard to make fun of tech titans that it became sort of a parody of itself. But here he is playing a character who is weird in a kind of sui generis way, right? I mean, there's not sort of an existing trope of a woke firefighter who's now really into interior decorating and tantric sex, right? And so he doesn't quite feel real, but he doesn't feel quite real in a way that feels wholly original. And there's a moment late in the movie when Penelope Cruz's character, who is like a psychotherapist and sexologist, is essentially performing a, you know, unlicensed therapy session for Olivia Wilde and Seth Rogen. And he just sort of pops up from behind the couch and is like, anyone for some rooibos, right? Like, it comes up with this, like, you know, sort of fancy kind of tea. It's literally like he rises out from the floor. I mean, you don't even notice that he's done it. And it is such a marvelously calibrated expression of who the character is, right? I mean, you have to think that Jones and McCormick spent a bunch of time just going back and forth over the tea choice. And like rooibos is a funny sounding word in that situation. It's like, you know, it is not a sort of first tier type of tea that you would pick. It demonstrated both an attention to detail and comic timing that I thought was a delight. I also think the movie does a really excellent job of establishing that while Cruz and Norton might be more uninhibited and having more sex than Benji and Olivia Wilde. Seth Rogen and Olivia Wilde. Seth Rogen's character's name is Benji, right? I couldn't tell you. That they're also just like they're not real together themselves, right? I mean, Edward Norton is a former patient of Penelope Cruz's, which is like, wildly unethical. You know, they are like, she is doing totally unlicensed and unasked for therapy in their apartment. You know, they talk a lot about sort of consent and the menu and then go ahead and start seducing their neighbors without like actually figuring out if they're okay. Like, they're pretty unhinged themselves for all of the, you know, pretensions to sort of enlightenment and liberation.
Important lesson in this is that if you look like Penelope Cruz, you can get away with anything. It's pretty much just the lesson of this film.
It's boob law, basically, yes. I'm the one who said it. Nobody else can get canceled. It's fine.
I didn't say anything. I didn't even laugh at that. I looked here stony-faced.
All I heard was Jude Law.
All right.
But yeah, I appreciate that this is a movie. It's an interestingly conservative movie because to a certain extent, it's like becoming unhinged and having sex with your upstairs neighbors is not actually the solution to your marital problems. And I do wonder how you both thought about the ending, which I've seen some critics describe sort of as a cop-out. I'm not sure that's how I felt about it, but I would be curious to know both of your takes on it.
Wait, cop out in what sense?
In that it's sort of a return to, I mean, spoiler alert, beat. Like, it kind of seems like Seth Rogen and Olivia Wilde are going to patch things up at the end of the movie.
That wasn't my read on that at all. That wasn't.
Really?
I strongly disagree with that.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me why. I am entirely open to the fact that I read that as,
look, their relationship was built in this formative moment when he was promising because he had a cool band. And she saw him on that stage and admired him from afar, and then did this slightly ridiculous, you know, sort of almost, rom-com type meet cute that she engineered by ditching her date and running back to the bar. And he wrote their one hit song was about her. And so both of them had this sort of idea, this promise about their themselves, how they would be individually in this relationship, and then about them, their relationship together. And the relationship didn't live up to that promise. The one thing they have still is that moment that they can go back to when it hadn't all fallen apart yet. And so what they do at the very end is they go back to that because that is the one thing they still have. And it's not, and it's a real thing. It's not going to go away. They had that moment, but that's the only moment they have, and they're not going to have another one. The thing they can do is sit at the piano and play a duet together, but they're not going to have a marriage that works because the marriage was predicated on a fantasy built out of that moment. That fantasy has, again, some tentacles or, you know, some grounding in truth, but it's not a real thing. And this movie is so psychologically perceptive along those lines about how people work and about what keeps them together and about also what makes those relationships tricky and difficult and even horrible and, you know, sort of deeply unpleasant at times, and how people lie to themselves even while they're sort of constantly talking to them. Like, one thing you can see, it's so great in this movie, is you can see the Rogen and Wilde characters, even if they are not literally talking to themselves, it's almost like you can hear their inner monologues running alongside in parallel to this movie. Right. Again, it's just, this is a movie that has such perceptive psychology to it. And I think that is a real true thing that I've seen this in relationships is that there's, you know, people are stuck together in something that is unpleasant, whether it's a marriage or whether it's just a sort of long-term dating type relationship where they came together and there was a real spark, but a spark isn't enough. You have to then learn how to live together and build a life that you want, that you both want together. And they didn't, they couldn't, because neither of them turned out to be the person that they imagined themselves to be. And then the other person didn't turn out to be the person that the other person imagined that they would be. They both became, in their own eyes, to some degree or another, failures. People, or at the very least, second raters, right? Rogen talks about this quite explicitly, but then there's that moment where Penelope Cruz's character asks Olivia Wilde, would she have sex with herself? And I don't even know if she gets out an answer that is yes or no, but she stammers and stumbles, and we have heard her talk about her anxieties about her body and how she looks, right? As many middle-aged people, right, you reach into your 40s. Olivia Wilde, the actress, is about our age. She was born in the early 80s, right? She's in her 40s, right? She looks, I mean, she has done quite well for herself, to be clear. But you can see this character has this deep anxiety about that, right? You see that in The Walking Naked, for people who haven't seen this, there's a whole subplot about how the fact that Olivia Wilde takes showers and then walks naked across their apartment in front of a window where Edward Norton's character can see her from another apartment, because she's anxious about her own body, but also wants to be desired for how she looks. And so there's this deep sense of, we didn't become who we wanted to be, but that is something that we can return to. And it's nice and it's pleasant and it's not enough. And so that's how I read the ending. And the more I think about this movie, the more I really admire it and like it because it's so perceptive in those ways. It's also, I think, a something of a difficult watch, especially at the beginning, but just all throughout. Like, this movie sort of had me, like, my shoulders tense Because if you've ever been in a situation in a household with a couple friends, or you know, with even as a kid with other parents, the parents of, say, you know, somebody else, you know, one of your friends, and you can see that this relationship isn't working out, man, it's tough. And this movie puts you there in that way, you know, in a way that's I think pretty rare to see on film, and especially rare to see it sort of drawn out in what amounts to sort of a single night, like a kind of extended moment, where you can just see this whole relationship kind of come apart, and you see all the layers, and you see why it's not coming back together.
Yeah, the question about the ending is interesting, because, you know, the way the film is constructed, over the opening credits, you hear Rogan teaching the piano piece to Olivia Wilde's character, and they're laughing and they're having fun, and it's like kind of flirty. And then they return to that exact sequence again at the end, just now, I guess, what, 20 years later or whatever, you know, some number of years later. And it is silence between them. She just kind of comes up and plays it. And I did not read that at all as like they were going to get back together. There is a cop-out ending to this film. There is a way to do a cop-out ending to this film, which is to have Seth Rogen go to bed with Olivia Wilde at the end of the film when she says, "I'm going to bed." And she clearly wants him to say, "I'm coming to bed as well." She wants that. I you know, either to have sex and repair their relationship or whatever. She wants that to come back together, I think. And he says, "Should I sleep on, I guess I'll sleep in my office." And she's just like, "Whatever." And it's that, at that whatever, I think that is where the relationship officially ends. I think that's it. I don't see that last piano bit as a cop out getting back together, which is interesting, because I'm surprised to hear people say that. I thought it was one of the strengths of the film, honestly, is that they did not have kind of a cop out, we're gonna fix everything sort of ending, because it's hard to make a movie like this without that.
Yeah,
I don't know. All right, so this is a movie with only 4 performances. We've said a lot of nice things about this movie. I'm going to say a mean thing about this movie. This movie with only 4 performances. I think Ed Norton is amazing as the kind of smarmy.
He's clearly the best of the 4.
Just, he's very, very good. He's very good at
he's
what he does.
Exceptional in this.
In a way that is very good. Yeah, he's given the widest range too, right? I mean, he gets that, you know, he both gets to be a complete weirdo and then gets the very sincere monologue again about his dead wife. Did you think that story was true, by the way?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, you talked about how the Penelope Cruz, and sorry to distract this, Sonny, but yeah. It's an interesting bit. You talked about how Penelope Cruz and Ed Norton are, you know, have their own problems and are maybe a kind of also a mess. But in a certain way, I think what the movie is trying to establish for us is they're unconventional, and maybe, yes, they have problems. They are not, you know, sort of perfect people who have perfect little lives. But what they do have is like a real kind of truth and like deep honesty and ability to communicate with each other. And that doesn't solve all of their problems. In fact, you know, sort of one of the twist, the reveal at the end is actually they do sometimes yell at each other and have sort of biting, nasty little bits, you know, right? But throughout the movie, we see, right, what does Norton constantly say to Rogan when he's complimenting? I like how it's basically all comes down to, I like how honest you are. And I think this movie is about how their relationship, the Norton-Cruz relationship, works and feels like it works because you can see that they're not lying to themselves and they're not lying to each other. And they've figured out a way to simply say in a mostly non-judgmental way what they actually feel, and then to accept that from the other person. And that's how, and so because they have this kind of communication, that's what makes their relationship tick and work, and also allows them to sort of be freer and open and sort of express themselves in this non-traditional, you know, with their sex parties, right? With a very non-traditional kind of sexual setup. And where you see, what you see conversely with the Rogan and Wilde relationship is they're lying to themselves
and they can't talk to each other. And when they do say what they feel to the other person rejects it as hostility every single time. And that is a nearly perfect consistent pattern, at least through the first 92% of the movie, where it's just one couple can talk to each other and the other couple can't.
Okay. Ed Norton, very good. I think Penelope Cruz, very good. I think Olivia Wilde, pretty strong in this. I think she like nails the, I think she does exactly what she sets out to do. Seth Rogen, did not work for me in this movie. And part of it is just the character, who is like a kind of unpleasant character. He's just whiny and morose and mopey. And like, in that sense, he does a very good job with it. But I just like, I just think he is working. Everybody else in this movie is working on two or three or four different registers. They are able to do different things. And he is just he has his awkward laugh and he has his like squinty glare. And it's a very limited performance compared to the other two. I like Seth Rogen in lots of things. I just did not think he worked here really at all. And I feel bad harping on this because it's a small thing, but there's only four actors in this movie, and it felt weak. It felt weak.
I didn't notice it quite that, but I did notice that there are bits where there was clearly some improvisational dialogue happening, and in those moments where the Rogan character is improving, basically, you know, sort of Rogan style quips, it kind of broke the character a little bit for me, right? Where it's just sort of like you could tell like they did 15 takes and he had said a different line each time, and then they cut in two or three of the funniest ones. Okay, but like this guy, sure, he was a performer, but he's not a stand-up comedian, and it's a little bit too kind of quippy Rogan-y at times. If we're going to talk about things that annoyed me a little bit, the other thing is just, while I totally understood what they were doing with the like kind of extreme, I don't know, psychological gaps between Rogan and Wilde, right? Like the ways that they just couldn't talk to each other, get anything done together. It struck me as slightly too aggressive, slightly, right? Like at every single moment, they go totally, not for each other's throats in a sort of physical violence way, but there's just nothing works. Yeah. And couples, even couples that don't work super well. I mean, I've had friends that have gotten divorced, right? Like, and who I've been close with both of them. And it sucks, right? It sucks for everyone involved, right? Much more for them. But like, you see it when you're, you know, you sort of, and I don't mean this, I like to say that I have a perfect, you know, sort of know exactly what divorce is like for everybody. It's complicated. But what you see is there's that tension, and it's almost always hidden slightly below the surface, and it's pretty obvious, but they have these little sort of strategies to cover it up, to make where they think they're hiding it from other people, where they think other people can't see it, or maybe they're just hiding it from themselves, who knows, but you don't see them, you don't see those sort of that layer of like masking strategy in this movie quite enough, because the movie just so clearly wants to make this point about good communication and open and honest communication versus selfish and lying communication.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Like, they definitely, for as well constructed as these two couple characters are, there is a zero to high order violence impact here that doesn't quite feel right. But maybe it's just representative of them being so tired of their situation. I don't know.
But one thing I think, one of the reasons I think that Norton and Cruz's performances are a little bit better is that they are given more registers to work in particular the moment where Norton's character corrects something, like some pronunciation that Cruz's character has. And she gets really mad at him, and they end up in the same kind of sort of stupid, aggressive tiff. And so you get to see that, you know, it's part of the movie's kind of curiosity about the cracks in their facade, right? And the sort of the flaws in their relationship. in a way that it doesn't have a corresponding ability to explore what drew Rogan and Wilde's characters to each other in the first place, right? Like, it tells us, but even then, it's a more like, you know, it tells us that she was on a bad date with someone and that he was kind of flirting with her from the stage, but it never gives us the zing of what that felt like. In a way, there's no mixture of like, is there still sexual attraction amidst the hostility? Like, no, they have a dead bedroom too. There's just no, you just don't see anything. You don't see any reason why they were ever together, right? And with Cruz and Norton, you see why they might eventually break up.
Yeah. Well,
The way that the Rogan Wilde relationship sort of comes together, I think, is entirely demonstrated in that credits bit that Sonny talked about, where we see, you know, essentially, right, and then it's fleshed out a little bit more in their meet cute story. But it's just entirely like you hear that at one point, 20 years ago, they were flirtatious and cute with each other. But the movie opens with that's totally gone.
Yeah. I think a secondary thing here is that, the fight between Norton and Cruz's character comes after they have been around this other couple for an hour. And like it shows like the infectiousness of that sort of negative energy, I thought, was kind of my read on it. But, you know, maybe also that's just an underlying thing. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on the invite? Alyssa.
Thumbs up. Although, as I told a coworker, it is not a good movie to watch with your parents.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Peter.
Thumbs up. I think it's a very good movie, maybe not quite a great one. And the one thing I will just add to this that we didn't talk about is Olivia Wilde's direction, the composition and the shot blocking in particular is just exquisite. Like this is, I think her performance is good. But I think her direction here and making this movie visually interesting and tell us so much about these characters by the way they move through space and by the way they are arranged in these rooms. It's really, really strong work.
Agreed. Cosine. She does a very good job of both expanding the space of this apartment and contracting it. The movie, considering it all takes place in one apartment, albeit a relatively big one, it can get pretty, it can be both, it feels both open and like very, when it needs to, tense and kind of tight, as one might expect in a bed, like, I don't know, what is that, a 3-bedroom apartment, 4-bedroom apartment? All right. I'll thumbs up for me. Pro this movie. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Munch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday. Hopefully.